This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
T-minus 10, go for main engine start. We are go for main engine start. T-minus 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery with the Hubble Space Telescope, our window on the universe.
Mission Control, Houston.
Roll program.
Roger, roll, Discovery.
Oh, that never gets old to me. Still gives me chills. A successful shuttle launch. That one happened to be on April 24th, 1990. Space Shuttle Discovery took the Hubble Space Telescope into low Earth orbit. Now, yes, Hubble was beset by mission-threatening faults early on. Its mirror wasn't quite right, and NASA's most expensive eyes in the sky to that date was returning fuzzy images. But they fixed it. And then the Hubble Space Telescope captured some of the most magnificent astronomical images we've ever seen. Like the Pillars of Creation, the birthplace of stars. Remember that one? Those glowing blue, green, yellow giant towers of gas and dust in the Eagle Nebula. And then there's the Hubble Deep Field. The telescope was pointed at a seemingly empty patch of sky, and it revealed thousands upon thousands of dots of light. Those dots? Thousands and thousands of galaxies. NASA scientist Michelle Thaler says in some of those smaller dots, we're looking at galaxies as they were 10 billion years ago.
And so when you see the Hubble Deep Field, you know, I can feel, you know, the hair rising on the back of my neck, and I'm getting goosebumps even just thinking about it. You know, through a tiny little pinhole, you can see the whole history of the universe right there.
Former NASA administrator and Hubble astronaut Charlie Bolden marvels at what's contained within each of those galaxies.
Billions of stars and billions of planets we know nowadays, and guess what? One of those planets in this image may have somebody like you or me or some other intelligent life form that we don't even know about yet, so we gotta keep searching. We gotta tell that story.
Well, Hubble has been in the sky for more than 30 years. On December 25th, 2021, NASA and scientists from around the world turned the page on Hubble and launched a telescope to tell the next chapter of the universe's story.
Trois, deux, unité, top.
And we have engine start. And liftoff. Décollage, liftoff from a tropical rainforest to the edge of time itself. James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
Christmas Day, last year, after a quarter century in development and at a cost of $10 billion, the James Webb Space Telescope was let loose on the stars. The Webb Telescope is the most risky, ambitious space observatory ever built. The Hubble orbits at about 300 miles up. The Webb's perch on the universe is 1 million miles away from Earth. That means both that there will be no astronauts flying out there to fix the scope if it fails. And NASA Administrator Bill Nelson says it also means the Webb will be able to see deeper, farther, and more clearly than Hubble ever could.
This telescope that is now going to take us back in time, it's a time machine. It's going to take us back to the very beginnings of the universe. We are going to discover incredible things that we never imagined.
The James Webb Space Telescope is already outperforming expectations. NASA recently released an early calibration shot that's the highest resolution infrared image ever taken from space. So let's learn a lot more about this marvel. I'm joined today by Marcia Rieke. She's a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona and the principal investigator for the near-infrared camera, or NIRCam, on the James Webb Space Telescope. She's with us from Tucson. Professor Rieke, welcome to you.
And thank you for having me.
Also with us today is Nicole Lewis. She's an assistant professor of astronomy and the deputy director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University, and a project scientist who will work with the telescope's near-infrared spectrograph, or the NIRSPEC. She's with us from Ithaca, New York. Professor Lewis, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Okay, so if my excitement for doing the show wasn't already evident, let me just declare it. I have been waiting all week to speak with the two of you. So let me ask you this first question. In those 28, 29 days between the launch of Webb on Christmas Day to when it finally arrived, let's call it at its parking spot in space, Professor Ricci, how well did you sleep?
I actually slept remarkably well because I'd waited so long for the launch, and the launch was perfect. And in that period of time while the telescope was getting to L2, it was very busy deploying all of its structures, and every one of those went perfectly. So it was a wonderful 28, 29 days with things going as perfectly as they could.
And we're going to talk about why that's, I don't know, it just makes my heart race thinking about how what was accomplished even just in that 28 days. But Professor Lewis, same question to you. I mean, did you also sleep peacefully every night?
Yeah, actually, after the first few days, which there were these major deployments that had to happen in order for the telescope to operate and actually communicate back with Earth, I kind of just slept soundly. I have not been involved in the project as long as Professor Ricci, but I know how much hard work and dedication went into making sure that JWST would work. And so after those first few deployments, I knew that we were in great shape.
Okay. I'm so relieved to know that both of you were okay, because I mean, just as a civilian watching the process from afar, I was on the edge of my seat for basically a month. But Professor Ricci, we'll talk about the science that the Webb telescope hopes to achieve. But let's stick with the engineering. Can you first just describe to us what the James Webb Space Telescope looks like? And then we'll talk about why the launch and the unfurling of it was so technically difficult. But what does it look like?
Well, it looks like a gold honeycomb suspended above a gold-colored sort of diamond shape that has five layers. And that diamond shape is the sun shield. And the five layers are there because it takes quite a bit of effort to make certain that the heat from the sun, the Earth, and the moon don't make it up to the telescope. And each layer is a bit colder than the one beneath it until we get to the telescope itself, which is at about minus 400 Fahrenheit, which is pretty cold, but that's how cold it has to be for the telescope to be sensitive to infrared light and for the instruments to work well. Yeah. And then the telescope has these 18 hexagonal segments that we now have taught to work like a single smooth mirror.
Yeah. So the two main parts there, first of all, that sun shield with the Kapton layers, right? Each layer being much thinner than a piece of paper and as big as a tennis court, an innovation, right, a complex innovation right there to, as you said, protect the telescope from the heat from the sun and the Earth, in fact. And then there's the mirror itself, 18 beryllium hexagons, right? Am I remembering it correctly, Professor Ricci?
That's right, and they have a very thin coating of gold.
And thin coating of gold. So, honestly, it's beautiful to look at in the pictures I've seen. Those 18 hexagons plus that massive sun shield, first of all, had to go inside a rocket. So, Professor Lewis, I mean, you've seen, both of you have seen the Webb in development. How did they fold it up to get it to go inside a rocket?
It took a lot of engineering to figure that out. I got to see JWST at different phases when it was at Goddard Space Flight Center and then also at Northrop Grumman. And it's still amazing. You have to think about how to fold this, you know, you need this big mirror. How do you fold something up like that to get inside of a rocket fairing? And then perhaps the most miraculous thing was the process of unfurling that sunshade that Professor Rieke talked about. And so a lot of very smart people thought long and hard about a way to fold it up and get inside of a rocket fairing that would be able to reliably deploy. But certainly it is one of the most complicated things that we've tried to do in space.
Well, so the unfurling process, there's what, 100? And this was what was happening in that couple of weeks between launch and when the web reached its sort of final orbital point, right? 144 release mechanisms. And 344 single points of failure or possible failure. I mean, engineers call them failure points, not because they failed, but those are places where things could go wrong. And the thing about the James Webb Space Telescope is that if any one of those things went wrong, no one could go out there and fix it. And yet, Professor Rieke, it all went off without a hitch?
Virtually no hitches at all. There were a couple of mechanism deployments where the little micro switch didn't latch on the first try and they just backed up a little bit and retried and everything was perfect. And given how hard it was to deploy the sun shield on Earth where there's gravity tugging on it, it actually went more smoothly in space than it did in the ground tests.
Wow. I mean, we could do a whole other hour about just the testing, because I understand some of the testing was done during Hurricane Harvey at the Johnson Space Flight Space Center in Houston. So, but fortunately, it all went off without a hitch. And I think all of us here on Earth are very excited, or at least I am, to see what kind of images the James Webb Space Telescope will soon bring back to us. And so we'll talk about that when we come back. Professor Marcia Rieke and Professor Nicole Lewis, stand by. This hour, we are marveling in the possibilities of the James Webb Space Telescope, and we'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the James Webb Space Telescope, a $10 billion quarter-century-long project between NASA, the European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, and thousands of scientists around the world. It is a million miles from Earth now, farther away than we could ever reach to fix it, but it is the most powerful space-based observatory humanity has ever put out into the sky. And I'm joined today by Marcia Rieke, professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona, also principal investigator for the near-infrared camera on the web. Nicole Lewis is with us. She's an assistant professor of astronomy and deputy director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell, and she'll work with the telescope's near-infrared spectrograph. So we've got two scientists who are going to look very, very far and a little bit closer with the web. So, Professor Rieke, let me just start with you. Infrared and one of the web's primary missions, which is to look as far back into the history of the universe as we possibly can. Tell me more about that.
Okay, well, the Hubble Space Telescope kind of set the table by observing the deep field and seeing that galaxies, there was no end to their distance and numbers, and Hubble eventually runs out of the ability to find any more distant ones because of the redshift effect due to the expansion of the universe. And so Hubble doesn't have much in the way of infrared capability, and the expansion of the universe literally moved the light too red for Hubble to detect it. So the main goal of Webb was to be an infrared telescope beyond red, further into the red, to see those galaxies that have been redshifted so much that Hubble couldn't detect them. And so that's the rationale for why Webb had to be big and had to have infrared capability, because otherwise it wouldn't see these most distant galaxies.
Now, in that first calibration image that was released to the public, we see this bright star in the foreground, and then in the background, we see hundreds of galaxies. Do we know how far away those galaxies are, just captured in this calibration image?
We don't know exactly how far most of them are. I gather that this is a field that some others observed before Webb was launched, and I don't have access to their data, but they know roughly, but there may be some surprises in this distribution that they didn't know about.
I see. But the point is that by looking very far away, because of the way things work, you're actually looking back in time, right?
That's right.
So tell me more about that.
Well, the way this works is that light doesn't move infinitely fast. It moves 186,000 miles per second, which is pretty fast. But it means that when we observe these distant galaxies, the light has been traveling for literally billions of years. And so we see that object in the state when the light left it, because that's how we're seeing it, the light that it produced. And so we're seeing it anywhere from, a few million years ago for nearby galaxies to 13 billion years ago for the most distant ones that we've been able to detect so far.
I mean, so it makes the James Webb Space Telescope like the most phenomenal time machine we've ever had. But why do you think it's important for us to capture these images, to get this data, to try to understand what the universe looked like 13 billion years ago?
Well, we'd like to understand how our own Milky Way came to be. That's part of the story. Part of the story is in the fact that our universe is filled with this dark matter that we don't know what it is. And the very first steps in the formation of galaxies is probably dictated by how matter interacts with this dark matter. And if we can understand the first steps in galaxy formation, we're going to understand a whole lot more about everything in the universe.
About everything. Okay. Professor Lewis, I appreciate you listening to Professor Riki with me on that. So looking back in time gives us more tools to understand everything in the universe. And you're going to be looking at things, is it fair to say that they're much closer? You're going to be looking at exoplanets. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be looking really in our cosmic backyard, okay? We're going to look at planets that are in our own solar system, and we're also going to look at planets that are around stars that are near to our own solar system. And so in looking at exoplanets, so exoplanets are planets that orbit stars other than our sun, what we're going to try to do is understand mostly what their atmospheres are made of, what their temperatures are, and really try to figure out how these planets sort of are similar or different from the planets in our own solar system. And then, of course, thinking about how the information we gain from these exoplanets might indicate that they could potentially be habitable and maybe support life.
So one of your early sort of areas of focus with the Webb is going to be around a star known as TRAPPIST-1. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's not just me. The TRAPPIST-1 system is of interest to many astronomers out there. And in fact, there are several programs that are going to be looking at each and every one of the seven Earth-sized planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system. And we're going to try to figure out, first, do they have atmospheres? And then potentially what those atmospheres are made of.
Okay. Because some of them, as you mentioned, are in that they call it the Goldilocks zone.
That's right. Three out of the seven planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system are in what we call the traditional habitable zone. So they're just the right distance from their star that's actually an sort of much, much cooler than our own sun, such that we think that there could be liquid water that's sustained on the surface. However, it's important that we actually look at all the planets in the system. It's a great opportunity to look at planets that are all roughly the size of Earth, but probably experienced very different sort of environments during their formation and evolution.
Okay. You know, I mean, what's so remarkable about this is that it took 25 years, right, for the full development and completion of the Webb telescope. And those 25 years were definitely marked by familiar problems, cost overruns, you know, political threats to cancel the program, obviously monumental challenges, technical challenges to be overcome. But at the same time, I mean, the whole field of exoplanetary sciences, did it even exist more than a quarter century ago, Professor Lewis?
I mean, not really. I, for one, am very thankful for the delays. A lot of things happened in those 25 years that allowed us not only to have a wealth of exoplanets to actually study with JWST, but also, you know, to sort of do some studies with facilities like Hubble and the now retired Spitzer Space Telescope, so that we're in a much better position to hit the ground running with JWST, which has instrument modes specially designed for looking at exoplanets.
Okay. Professor Rieke, how closely related are the sort of two aspects of the universe that both of you are going to be looking at, the origin story of the universe, and then, you know, the question of understanding closer planets to Earth? How closely related are they?
They're actually related through a lot of things in astronomy. The most distant galaxies will have the first stars, and those first stars are the ones that eventually blow up and distribute their materials that they've made in their cores, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen that we all count on, which then go into forming planets in the next generation, orbiting the next generation of stars. And so there's kind of a continuous thread from the exoplanets nearby that are made out of literally stardust, and some of that stardust came from the very first generations of stars. So we can weave a timeline that connects all of these pieces together.
Oh, and Professor Lewis, is that how you'd answer that question?
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, you're trying to put everything in context, right? And so we have to understand how the universe formed and evolved that eventually gave rise to the very special place and home we call Earth. And so, you know, I do see that as a very strong connection. I also see strong connections in the fact that often we are looking for a lot of the same chemical signatures, both in the earliest galaxies and then also in planets nearby.
Mm. Well, so we have sort of a follow-up question coming from D. Campbell, listener D. Campbell, who wants to know more about what basic science questions could be answered using the James Webb Space Telescope. Professor Rieke, what do you think?
Well, it depends on how basic you want to get. But I mentioned earlier that how galaxies formed, how many big pieces, how many little galaxies formed, is dictated by this stuff we call dark matter. And so in the sense of testing some of the basic physics theories about this mysterious dark matter, we should learn quite a bit about that by studying the relative size distribution of those first galaxies. And something that we can't predict or talk about exactly is that we may find something that we don't understand that isn't predicted that may shed a lot of light on our understanding of things.
I see. And Professor Lewis, same to you.
Yeah, I think you know, one of the big questions, at least for me as a planetary scientist, is again putting sort of our solar system in context. And we're asking some fairly basic questions about these exoplanets that we're looking at, simple things like, do they have air? Also, just trying to understand if, you know, a lot of the what we call chemistry or the atmospheric makeups, clouds, hazes, et cetera, that we see throughout our solar system are prevalent in planets around other stars.
Hmm. So I wonder if we could just take a step back here for a second, because I just do want to note that I'm really delighted to be talking to two just fantastic women scientists. I mean, how much over the past, just say over the development of the Webb telescope, how much has the field of astronomy changed in terms of who goes into it, who's leading, you know, major projects, you know, and there are many leaders on a huge project like the Webb. And Professor Rieke, how much has it changed over that time?
Oh, it's changed hugely, because I remember in the early days of project meetings, I was one of the few women. And now if you go to the Mission Operations Center and see the crew that's actually running the telescope, it must be pushing, you know, 40% women now. It's just been an amazing change. And this isn't just in the science side of the house. There are many more female engineers participating now. And it's been really amazing to see the change in the population over the course of this project.
And Professor Lewis, I mean, from what I understand, that sort of drawing in of new and diverse talent is really seen in exoplanetary studies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, exoplanetary studies is still a relatively young field. And, you know, I'm actually part of the old guard at this point. and so it has been really interesting. And so as we've seen, as Professor Rieke noted, more diverse people from different backgrounds, you know, different lived experiences coming into astronomy, they're immediately finding space within exoplanetary science because it's a relatively new field, and there's lots of new spaces to occupy.
I love that. I really do. because if we're truly to understand everything, which is what the universe is, we need the best scientists and engineers from all different points of view to bring their ideas and their questions, right? Because how the Webb telescope is going to be used is determined by the questions that scientists around the world want to ask. So, Professor Lewis, can you tell us a little bit about the process that's going on where that determines what experiments will be done over the different phases of the Webb's lifespan?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways that what we call programs are selected for JWST. You know, in the beginning, there are folks that have contributed significant amounts, including Professor Rieke and others, who have time allocated so that they can leverage the telescope to do lots of important studies. And so that's part of what's going to happen, especially early in the life cycle. The other part of it is mostly what we call a general observer proposals. And so this is where the community puts out their best ideas. They write proposals. They submit those proposals. They're reviewed by a panel of peers. And I will note that one of the things that has carried over from the Hubble Space Telescope in this same process that's being used for JWST is that all of these proposals are reviewed using what's called a dual anonymous system, meaning we don't know the identity of the proposers when we review those proposals. It focuses on what's the most interesting and exciting science that can be done almost exclusively with JWST. And in the end, not everyone's proposal will be selected. And, you know, I was part of teams that put in almost two dozen proposals in the first cycle and came out with basically six selected ones. And so there's a little bit of, not everyone's going to get time, but we all have good ideas in terms of what we would like to do and see. And then those selected proposals go into determining what actually is observed during a given year with JWST.
I see. And so, Professor Rieke, I understand that because of this sort of dual anonymous system, many of the proposals that have been accepted are coming from junior scientists. Is that right?
That's right, because by having a dual anonymous system, the old boy network kind of gets short-circuited, and the proposals are evaluated strictly on the qualities of the proposal itself. Are the proposers asking an important question? Do they appear to understand how to use the facility? Is it technically feasible? So all of those kind of criteria, not the old, well, you know, that guy's been a success over and over, and I'm sure he'll be a success here. That kind of thing doesn't enter anymore. And so that gives the younger folks a much better chance.
Now, I can't see your face because you're in Tucson and I'm in Boston, but did you maybe have a little grin on your face when you said it's circumventing the old boy network in astronomy?
Yeah, I mean, there's, if you go back and look in the sort of middle age of Hubble proposals, I think there was quite a bit of that going on, and it's much better to skip that.
Yeah. Well, we're talking this hour about the James Webb Space Telescope. It's 1 million miles from planet Earth, the largest, most complex, most ambitious space observatory humanity's ever put into the sky. And we'll learn a lot more about what we hope to gather from the data the Webb will send back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next week, we're going to return our focus to more problems here. Back on planet Earth, we're going to be talking about the ongoing extreme teacher shortage in public schools across the country. So we want to hear from you if you're an administrator, obviously if you're a teacher or a former teacher, parents who have children in school and have been experiencing teacher shortages in your school. What has that been like? Why did you, if you're a teacher, why did you leave teaching? What changes would have convinced you to stay? What do we need to change about public education, about teaching, to attract more great teachers to this important profession? Call us with your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for next week. Today, though, we're giving ourselves a chance to focus on wonderful science that opens our minds, and it's happening 1 million miles away from Earth. We're talking about the James Webb Space Telescope, the $10 billion telescope that was essentially folded up or engineering origami into an Ariane 5 rocket, launched into space, and then over the course of 28 days, unfurled 1 million miles away to take some of the most, hopefully over the next several years, some of the most revealing pictures and bring back data about the origins of the universe and potential planets much closer to home. Professor Rieke, for folks who, you know, may be listening to this and aren't as familiar with the history of this space-based telescope data gathering, can you just tell us big picture, sort of what the James Webb Space Telescope means for science overall?
Well, first, it means that people can get together from many countries and make something extremely complicated work. And I think that's an achievement in and of itself, and that it shows that science is still a venue where very diverse groups of people can work together to achieve a fantastic goal. And there's no doubt that what we learn from Webb is going to really rewrite the astronomy textbooks. That old cliche is going to be true, because this is the first time we've had this kind of capability in space, infrared wavelengths when observed from the ground, are very compromised by the Earth's atmosphere and the Earth's heat. And this is just going to be such a fantastic view. And the instrument that Nicole is working with, the NearSpec, it's the first time we've had anything like that capability in space. And so we're going to learn things that we can only guess now.
Yeah, I so appreciate the way you said that, Professor Rieke, because, we've been through the past several years of, obviously politics, pandemics, war, just one example after the other about how human beings are really good at not cooperating with each other for the greater good. And so it's so heartening to have to focus for a moment on this decades-long effort, international effort, like you said, of like just intense cooperation to expand human knowledge. Professor Lewis, what do you think about that? Like, is there going to be sort of are there going to be ripple effects from that across science?
Yeah, most certainly. And I think one of the interesting things about JWST in particular, focusing on, new sort of innovations that have happened beyond all the technological innovations, I want to highlight that there are these programs called Early Release Science programs that were given as what's called part of director's discretionary time, and they were meant to build communities. And so different communities around different scientific topics came together, and they really thought about what is it that I need right away from JWST in order to make rapid scientific progress. And so those programs will be hopefully executed within the first 4 months of science operation with JWST. But there are massive communities behind these programs. And I think that that's how we are going to move forward in science. I think there's going to be a lot more community-driven science because we've gotten to the point where that's the way to make significant progress.
Yeah. I'm excited. Are you excited, Professor Lewis? This feels like such an exciting time for astronomy.
Yeah, I mean, I am very excited. I'm also overwhelmed, to be fair. the data are going to start coming down sooner than I probably, am ready for. And it's going to be like drinking from a fire hose. So I'm excited and trying to brace myself for what is going to be an overwhelming amount of new data that's going to tell us new and probably unexpected things about the universe.
Yeah. And that continues to keep it exciting, the unexpected part. Look, we've just got a couple of minutes left, and I'm eager to hear from both of you. Professor Rieke, I'll start with you. What brought you into this field? What made you decide that you wanted to dedicate your life to it? And why do you, how does it keep you going?
Well, what keeps me going is the chance of finding out something that no one else has ever known before. And I got into the field because I like to read science fiction books. I was lured by the idea of visiting exoplanets, although we didn't call them that in those days. But science fiction books were full of planets around other stars. And it just seemed like this was the frontier now, where you could go explore and do things and get challenged in ways that you couldn't otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And do you remember any of your favorite books from when you were younger?
Oh, I remember an author. I read books by, of course, Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein. Those were the ones that got me into this. And what keeps me going is this lure of being able to do something that no one's done before.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Lewis, same question to you. I also understand that you're a fellow Space Camp alumna.
I am. I would almost venture to say I was a little bit of a Space Camp junkie. I went once, and then I went six more times.
Oh my God! I only went once, so I'm jealous now.
I grew up, I will say that, part of what drove me into sort of scientific research is I've always been a person who enjoys puzzles. trying to solve something that maybe nobody else has figured out before. And I grew up in the era of Star Trek The Next Generation. I would be plastered to my television every, each week when the new episode would come on. And so, astronomy and planetary science really bring together that whole puzzle solving and then exploration of the universe that lays beyond Earth together. And so it has been, the core of this passion that keeps me going in this career.
Oh my gosh, I'll have to have you back on so we can do a whole episode about our favorite TNG shows, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So let's put on I also want to note that you told the New Yorker that for example, your grandmother really supported you in your love for math. Mm-hmm. And that was quite important in getting you on this path. So those early experiences we learn over and over again shape people. Now, we have about just quickly 1 minute left here, and Professor Riki, let's put our next steps hats back on to understand what is going to happen next with the web. When do you expect to start getting data and images that are actually from experimentation?
We're hoping that we'll be done with this commissioning by the middle of June. Right now we're waiting for the mid-infrared instrument to get fully cold, and then we can finish commissioning. So I hope that we can unleash the flood of neat stuff before the end of June.
Okay, so this summer. That's just around the corner. That's only a couple of months away. Wow. Okay, well, Professor Marcia Riki, Professor of Astronomy at the University of Arizona and the principal investigator for the near-infrared camera, or the NIRCam, on the James Webb Space Telescope with us from Tucson. Professor Riki, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much. Congratulations and good luck on everything.
Thank you very much.
And Nicole Lewis, Assistant Professor of Astronomy and Deputy Director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University, and Project Scientist, who's going to be working with the telescope's near-infrared spectrograph. Professor Lewis, thank you so much, and best of luck with that fire hose as it rains down on you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
One of the most wonderful things about science and discovery, if you ask me, is that it is the purest kind of team collaboration. Very, very rarely can we pinpoint one person who revolutionized what science knows and understands about the world. Instead, it's a process, one that takes decades or centuries and evolves due to the life's work of thousands of people. Now, this couldn't be more true for something as complex as the James Webb Space Telescope. You will never know the names of everyone who worked on the web. You'll likely never know the thousands more scientists whose innovations and discoveries in fields from material science to mathematics were instrumental in getting a human telescope 1 million miles from Earth. So, for the last few minutes of today's show, let's turn one of those unknowns into a known. Allow us to introduce to you Professor Robert A. Gonzalves, creator of an imaging technique known as phase retrieval.
I invented this stuff in 1975 at age 30. I helped NASA fix the Hubble telescope in 1990 at age 50. And JWST is going to use the same phase retrieval algorithm in 2022 at age 87.
Gonzalves' innovation is a boon to astronomy for a number of reasons. For example, it doesn't require any ancillary hardware.
Phase retrieval is the very last step to make sure that everything is tuned up sharp as can be.
And if images from a space telescope aren't as sharp as they can be, all you've got is an extremely expensive hunk of mirrors and instruments returning super fuzzy and virtually useless pictures, much like the Hubble Space Telescope first did back in 1990. NASA couldn't replace Hubble's giant mirror. Instead, they built replacement instruments that fix the flaw much in the same way a pair of glasses correct the vision of a nearsighted person. And it was Gonzalves' phase retrieval technique that snapped Hubble's images into razor-sharp focus and allowed humanity, for the first time ever, to see clearly spectacular images like the birthplace of stars.
Well, first of all, phase retrieval is an algorithm. It's an unconventional imaging technique which clarifies an unknown flaw in an imaging device. It's similar to autofocus. Without these corrective improvements, images will be blurred. So really what phase retrieval does is it gives you a prescription to fix what's wrong in the telescope. That's what it does. When I went to Northeastern University to get my PhD, I learned about a lot of things that really I thought were going to be kind of useless, because that's usually what happens when you write a PhD thesis. You have these things that demonstrate that you know how to do research, but you're not anticipating that it will ever be anything that's interesting. Well, my research when I got my PhD was on phase diversity. It really didn't have any application then, and nobody cared about it until they did. And that's when they found a problem with the Hubble.
Engineers have discovered that the giant telescope has a warped mirror.
One of the mirrors in the Hubble Space Telescope is out of shape.
And really, it was a simple matter. Namely, what they needed was a prescription. All you do is you have to put a lens in front of the camera that you're using, and it'll fix it. But you need to know what's wrong with it. And some people were just astonished that we could do what's called phase diversity. We could take an image and from that image figure out the prescription that would fix this telescope. And it was very easy for me. And the reason it was very easy for me, because I was teaching my students how to do that. I didn't know it was going to be used for this purpose. It was just something that I was interested in. We nailed it within a month or two, and then we had to wait 3 years until two astronauts could get up in the sky and actually put the prescription in place. And then, at first light a few days later, the images were beautiful. My students, that were yelling and screaming, look at how good we did it. The errors that were made on the Hubble telescope were 1/50th the size of a hair. So, I mean, that is really tiny. Well, the tolerances for the James Webb are 10 times higher than that. I mean, because they're looking so deep into space, and it's really incredible. I'm interested in algorithms, I'm interested in fixing things, and I'm interested in doing research, and that's about what I've done. Of course, I'm also interested in teaching. In fact, I taught at Northeastern University for 23 years. I taught at Tufts for another 30 years. I've always really known that I'm a teacher, and it came from the fact that my parents were teachers. And so I started helping people learn math and other things at around age 14. And I learned quickly what I had to do to help people to understand things. And I've done that my whole life. My whole life I've been helping people, and I love it. I mean, I had 10,000 students, and I'm still in touch with a lot of them. One of my students wrote, "Bob, you were the best teacher I ever had in grad school at Northeastern University. Your skill is in being able to make us understand mathematics behind optics and mathematical physics was key in my training, and everyone else lucky enough to have you as a professor. It's no surprise that you were the father of the wonderful technology for the JWST.
Robert A. Gonsalves, professor emeritus at Tufts University and father of the phase retrieval imaging technique now being used by the James Webb Space Telescope. And the JWST is going to tell the stories of the origins of the universe. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.